Hey everyone, welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast of the Financial Times. This is the 50 Shades of Great Economic Strides edition. I'm Cardiff Garcia. And producer Amy Keene, can't believe I used that as an intro. On the show today, I speak with my FT colleague Tim Harford, an economist, columnist, and author of the just-released 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. This book is a companion to the podcast series that Tim hosts for the BBC World Service, in which he devotes each 10-minute episode to the story behind a single transformative invention. And Tim has recently published a few stories for the FT on the relevant lessons of our technological past. To discuss all this and more, Tim joins me from his recording studio in Oxford, England. This is going to be a lot of fun. Tim, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back, although that really was a terrible, terrible 50 Shades pun, but
admittedly
well done.
Pretty awful.
Well done,
but
though,
you know, sometimes a bit of levity at one's own expense is just the thing to get things started. Tim, my first question is this. This project strikes me as the kind of project done by someone who reads, like you do, 4 to 5 books at a time, and then starts drawing connections between the themes therein. Is that sort of what triggered the idea to do this, that you just started coming across all of these different ideas, and then you realized that they were all interconnected?
I think, if I'm honest about the moment inspiration struck, it was probably talking to Stephen Johnson, who's written some great technological histories. The most recent book he wrote is called Wonderland, about play and the modern world, but he's written a whole bunch. And I was interviewing him on stage for the FT in London. And I think after I left that interview, I started thinking, oh, you know, you could do a whole series. You could do one a week. And then, you know, the idea of doing a BBC series of doing, let's do 100 or 50 or however many. And then, of course, the book comes naturally after that. And then once you've had the idea, and obviously I'm not the first person to come up with some extended listicle series of 50 things or whatever. Once you've had the idea, you immediately start remembering the great technological histories that you've read. So the ones that immediately sprung to mind were the shipping container, of course, Mark Levinson's great history called The Box, all about the shipping container, Emek Basker talking about the barcode. There must be something to be done about the barcode. Paul David on the dynamo and the steam engine, and Claudia Goldin on the contraceptive pill. So there's real classics in the field of economic history. I'm not an expert on economic and technological history, but then once you start digging, more and more and more stuff comes up, and there are some really surprising choices in there. But I can't wait. I could do another 50, no problem. The joy of working on this series is that it's each of these stories lets you focus the spotlight on a particular thing and tell a story. It's often a human story. There's often a parable. And it avoids a lot of the problems you often have talking about economics, which is that economics is often very abstract. There are all these hidden connections. Everything connects to everything else. It's hard to really explain what's going on. But when you look at something and you say, look, when the barcode was developed, this is the guy who invented it. This is what they had to go through to get it adopted. This is how it changed the world. You've actually got a lot of economics in there as well, but you've started with a human story. So that's why it was so much fun to work on.
My experience of listening to the podcast series was that it was as much about rediscovery as it was discovering new things, because as you would go on to write in a recent story for the FT, often the inventions that made the biggest difference sound quite humble. They appear quite humble, but they end up having massive reverberations for the way we live. So let's talk about that. Tim, you're saying in your piece that when we try to imagine the future, the past offers two lessons. What are those lessons?
So the first lesson is that we tend to focus on the incredibly sophisticated inventions. So we get caught up in the idea of the robots, artificial intelligence, nuclear fusion. But actually, when you look back at the past, it's often not the spectacular inventions like electricity. Of course, it makes a huge difference. But it's also the really everyday stuff. I'll give you an example in a second. The second mistake that we make is that we imagine new technologies just slotting into our existing systems and changing things because they're super, super cool. So they do what we were doing anyway, but they do it better. So they solve a problem for us. And actually, it doesn't normally work like that. Normally what happens is a new invention gives you new possibilities, new ways to do things, new opportunities, and it has an impact for good or bad on our economy and on our society, because we make all sorts of accommodations, we make all sorts of adjustments to fit that that innovation. So as an example of the first mistake, there's the focusing on the technological wizardry. I talk about the Gutenberg Press. And Gutenberg Press, everybody said when I started working on this book, oh, I'm looking for 50 really cool, interesting inventions. Everyone said the Gutenberg Press, the Reformation, textbooks, novels, newspapers, mass literacy, super important. Of course it's important. But then the more I looked at it, the more I found myself falling in love with something much more humble, which was paper. Because the press and paper go hand in hand. You can print on parchment. Gutenberg did print some of his Bibles on parchment, which is made of animal skin. But it doesn't make any economic sense because parchment's very expensive. And the whole point of the printing press is that you save money if you have a long print run. So it doesn't make any sense to mass produce writing until you can mass produce a writing surface. And that was paper, which of course was transformative in all kinds of other ways. So you drink orange juice out of paper cartons, you filter coffee through filter paper, you put wallpaper on your wall, paper receipts, contracts, everything. So focusing on the humble stuff like paper is very important. The second lesson, this of social adjustment, it is most famously made by Paul David in an essay published in 1990 called The Computer and the Dynamo. And Paul David looks back to the introduction of electricity in manufacturing in America in the late 19th century, which initially was a flop. You had good electric motors introduced in, say, 1890. I mean, a little bit earlier than that, but they should have worked by 1890. And if you had interviewed somebody who was watching this kind of thing in 1890, they would have said, yeah, all the steam engines are going to go, they're going to be replaced by electric motors. Didn't happen. Didn't really happen seriously until the 1920s. And that wasn't because we were waiting for a better electric motor. It was because the manufacturing firms had to figure out how to reconfigure their factories, change their HR, their personnel, the contracts, the kind of people they hired, the other equipment they installed in the factories, the architecture of the factories, the flow around the production line, to take advantage of things you could do once you had electric motors. Initially, they didn't do that. They just ripped out big steam engines and replaced them with big electric motors, and nothing really changed. So the electric motor changed everything once everything changed to accommodate the electric motor. And Paul David then said, maybe the same is true of computers. Maybe the same is true of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I found that lesson so profound is that you can apply it to the present day, where there seems to be a contradiction between, on the one hand, these astonishing advances that we hear about or that we read about, that we know are happening in things like nanotechnology, robotics, and so on. And then on the other hand, we know, for instance, that the productivity growth statistics are very weak, they're very disappointing, and people sort of wonder what's going on. But it could just be the case that these technologies really are as astounding as we think they are. It's just that societally, we haven't reorganized ourselves well enough yet to fully embrace them in such a way that they're going to rapidly increase our living standards. But it could be coming. There really could be amazing things happening that will one day change fundamentally how we live. We just have to wait a little while.
It could be, yeah. So one theory is, oh, we're just mismeasuring productivity. But I mean, yes, a bit, maybe to some extent, but it's really hard to make the case that productivity is soaring, which is what you would expect if we have all these technological breakthroughs. So a much more plausible theory. Well, one possibility is all this stuff is just not that good compared to electricity, the internal combustion engine, indoor plumbing. Robert Gordon is the guy who most famously makes this case. He makes it very well. But then the other idea is, well, maybe they're not that good yet, but they will become good. They will profoundly reshape our economy and boost productivity, but they'll only do it once we figure out how to reorganize society. And you see, I mean, a really straightforward example of this, which is uppermost in people's minds at the moment, is the so-called gig economy. Here in the UK, Matthew Taylor, a prominent think tanker and former advisor to Tony Blair, just published a report on what are we going to do about the gig economy. I know Alan Krueger, former advisor to President Obama, has been thinking about this a lot. And you realise there's this, we have these new technologies that potentially replace whole corporate structures by just connecting people who want to be given a ride somewhere with people who have a car. You have a restaurant that's cooking pizza, you have some people who want pizza, you have some app that gets in the middle of that and just connects the pizza restaurant with the customer. And you don't need this big corporate structure, the technology allows it. This is just a straightforward everyday example, it's nothing particularly sophisticated. We're really struggling with what to do about this. Like, how do we pay these people? What benefits do they get? What pensions do they get? And you feel we're really stuck. I mean, it's right that we agonise about this and try and figure out how best to do it, but we're really stuck in a mid-20th century, you know, 1930s, 1940s mindset, and the technology is moving on. And until we figure out what to do with this, and this is just one example, we're not really going to unleash the productivity gains.
Yeah, the example that always comes to mind, partly because it's come up on this podcast a few times, is driverless or autonomous vehicle technology. In part because it's sort of obvious that we're not yet ready to embrace it at a very large scale, because we have to, for instance, figure out how to develop the kind of traffic system that would allow for, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of cars on the street at the same time, all being autonomously driven. We have to figure out what to do about insurance contracts and who's liable for accidents, things of that nature. But it could also well be the case that the technology itself, yes, it will be transformative if it leads to a lot of driverless vehicles, but it could also be used one day in ways that we haven't really imagined yet. It could be more transformative than we even realize, simply because it hasn't sort of played out yet. Like, we haven't given it time to develop further, and we haven't thought of all the different applications that it might one day have.
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, I haven't thought of the applications myself, so I've got no crystal ball. The obvious thing that strikes
me... You sure wouldn't be telling me on this podcast. You'd be patenting it somewhere.
Cardiff, you would be the first person to know. You know that. You know that. But I mean, one thing that immediately strikes me about that is that we're still stuck in the model of driverless cars integrating with cars which have drivers. We've got our old model of drivers and roads and the rules of the road, and we're going to try and make driverless cars integrate with that. And an obvious alternative model is to say, no, we could make this so much easier, more efficient, environmentally efficient, efficient in terms of congestion, and safer if we just banned all the humans from driving cars. We just get rid of all the humans and only robots are allowed to drive cars. And they would just, you could put machine readable markings on the road and they could drive in convoys. It would just be enormously easier. And maybe, you know, some city somewhere, maybe it's going to be California, maybe it's going to be somewhere in China, maybe it'll be Singapore. Somebody's just going to go, hang on a minute, that we would maybe be making so much more progress with this if we just got rid of the human drivers, who are really causing all the problems for the robots. The robots would be driving cars already if it wasn't for the humans gumming things up. So, yeah, sometimes you need to step back and rethink.
Okay, so the piece in the FT is called What We Get Wrong About Technology. We're going to put a link to that up at ft.com/alphachat. But let's shift now to 50 inventions that shaped the modern economy. That's the title of the book in the US. In the UK, I believe it is still 50 things that made the modern economy.
It is, yeah. One technology we don't have sorted yet is a technology for making US and UK publishers agree on book titles. But yeah, so the UK edition is out now. And the podcast is available now, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. And the US edition is out in a few weeks, towards the end of August.
Yes, highly recommend all of it. Tim, what I thought we would do is go through one example from each of the seven categories that you give in the book. And I want to start with the chapter Reinventing How We Live, and specifically with the technology of video games. This was probably, I think, my favorite entry in the book and in the series. You met an economist named Edward Castronova, I think more than a decade ago. He made an intriguing prediction. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so Castronova wrote a book, and I met him just before the book was published, where he said, look, people are going to check out of reality and they're going to spend their time playing video games. And Castronova had a particular kind of video game in mind. He wasn't thinking of Pokemon Go and all these smartphones. He was thinking about persistent online worlds, the most famous one of which is probably World of Warcraft. So this world is always out there. It's an entirely fictional world full of orcs and dragons, but you can log in and you can meet your friends online and go on quests, accept all kinds of challenges, participate in wars, set up your own economy, and the world will always be there. So you log out and your character is kind of is out of the picture for a while. When you log back in, the world may have changed a bit. And Castronova initially came to prominence by estimating the GDP of one of these worlds, because he said there are virtual goods traded in these worlds that have a real economic value, dollar value. People will pay other people to do the boring bits and then sell them the magic items or sell them the highly skilled character. So you can calculate the wage inside this virtual economy. And a lot of people were interested in this, but Castronova said, no, it's what's much more important than the idea that people will be logging in, playing games for money in Nairobi or Calcutta and selling there's going to be this trade in virtual sweatshops. He saw all of that coming. But he said, no, more interesting is people will just, they play games because the games are fun, the games are challenging, and they're bored of real life. Now, when he told me this, we were in this workshop in DC, we're surrounded by policy wonks and scientists, and a lot of people were skeptical. And he said, look, you guys, you're winning the game of real life. But not everybody can win the game of real life. But you can win in World of Warcraft or any of these online games. Why would you want to work 50 hours a week as a Starbucks barista when you could spend 50 hours a week being a starship captain? And then he published his book. It was called Exodus to the Virtual World. And everyone said, well, yeah, it's kind of interesting sort of science fiction speculation. And then about 18 months ago, reports started coming out of four economists, Marc Aguiar is the lead author, who had started tracking evidence that Castronova was right, that these video games were starting to affect the labor market in the US because people were spending so much time having fun on video games, they didn't want to do boring jobs. And why would they? So, yeah, very interesting interaction between the virtual world and the real world.
Yeah, the other authors on that paper were Mark Bills, Kerwin, Kofi Charles, and Eric Hurst, and we'll put a link up to that as well in the show notes. You know, what's interesting about this, Tim, is that if someone only has the surface-level knowledge of the trend you just described, it would all sound very irresponsible. You know, somebody who, instead of choosing to work, to make a living for themselves, to maybe start a family and then provide for that family, is essentially checking out, as you said, to play video games. But there's a sense in which we actually should be quite understanding of why young people in particular in their 20s would make that choice. You mentioned some of the reasons, which is that these games keep getting better and better. They're a lot of fun. But if you think about it, they also offer some of the things that we know make for a fulfilling job in the real physical world, such as autonomy. You get to make a lot of decisions for yourself. It gives you the potential for mastery and for making progress as you move through different levels. And now they even give you a sense of sociability because, of course, a lot of these games are these online games that you can play with other people. And these are people with whom you can develop actual friendships. Maybe not friendships the way we traditionally define friendships in the time before video games, but still relationships nonetheless that can matter. And I think all that actually has to be taken into account before we apply too strong a judgment against people who make that choice.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about the choice that people are making because you spend, you know, the years of your life from, say, 15 to 30 playing video games because they're such fun. Then maybe you start thinking, hey, maybe I should start thinking about a pension and starting a family, and you suddenly realize you've missed all those formative years when you could have been picking up all the skills and contacts and education. So it could be that this is going to be behavior a bit like not saving for a pension. Completely understandable, very human, in the long run, very worrying. So, you know, I'm not saying we should just relax about this and it's no big deal. But as you say, it's very understandable behavior. It tells us a lot about how tedious reality is for a lot of people. And even people who love their jobs, I love my job, play games. I don't play computer games, as it happens, because they give me motion sickness, because they're so good, I get travel sick. But I play role-playing games, I play board games, I play them with family, I play them with friends. I don't see anything wrong with that. And some of the friendships, deepest friendships in my life, I made by playing silly games about dragons and knights. In the long run, the interesting question is, well, surely more and more of this stuff is going to go virtual. More and more of the experiences that we have are not going to be, you know, physically going to the theater or going to the cinema. We're going to be at home playing in virtual worlds. We'll be plugged into the holodeck. So we need to start thinking about what that means, and is that a problem, and should we worry about it? Otherwise we're just going to be Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, or The Matrix is all around the corner if we don't think about what our policy should be on this sort of thing.
Yeah, indeed. And the authors of the paper, I believe, have also cited some circumstantial but still powerfully suggestive evidence that the young people who play these games in their 20s are quite happy, but that their happiness sharply declines when they get into their 30s, possibly, again, just hypothesizing, this has to be studied quite a bit more, but possibly because they haven't developed the kind of labor force skills that would serve them well later in life. There's one other element to this that's interesting, which is the direction of causality, which is often debated by economists and by economic observers. So typically, I think the criticism of some interpretations of this paper is that, well, yeah, of course, a lot of young people are playing games. The labor market has been really quite crap the last decade or so. So it makes sense that they would do that, and that's what the problem is. Make the jobs better, and then people will end up stop playing games, and they'll take the job because the job itself pays more money or offers more autonomy, or it just is better. There's more competition for the workers, and so they'll want to, you know, capitalize on that.
Or they'll play games as well as work. I mean, we have 168 hours a week. You know, there are times to play games and work as well. So, but yeah, I'm sure causation runs both ways, and it must run both ways. But one of the interesting things about the paper is that the authors point out that young women don't. I mean, young women still play games, but they don't play as many games as young men, and young women are not disconnected from the labour market in the same way that young men are. We should remind ourselves, by the way, that the actual unemployment rate in the US is at a 16-year low. I mean, if you were looking for a job, it does seem like you should be able to find a job. Lots of people disconnected and discouraged and not even looking for work. But if you're looking for work, it seems, at least in principle, like you should be able to find it. So young women, not disconnected from the labor market, not playing games. Older men, they've really suffered because of some of the economic trends in the US, but they're not disconnected from the labor market. This is, you know, men from between the ages of 30 and 55 in the same way that younger men are. It's a little speculative. It's you know, this is not super high quality evidence, but these authors have tried to make the case. I think they make a plausible case that some of this is about video games pulling people, young men, out of the labor market, rather than these young men being pushed away from the labor market and then taken to video games because they've got to do something.
Yeah, and in one sense also, I think there's a risk of overthinking this. If these games keep getting better and better and better, as I don't see any reason to doubt that they will, it simply raises the opportunity cost of leaving the game playing world and taking a job. It doesn't mean that those jobs can't someday exist or that they don't in some parts of the labor market. It just means that, for instance, the labor supply curve in economics terms has moved up and to the left, that for a given level of employment supply, you need to make those jobs a little bit better somehow. They need to compensate you a little better somehow, whether it's in wages or in benefits or in intangible or something else. So I actually don't have a problem believing that these guys are right, though I do hope that it continues to be studied. In the meantime, it's such a fascinating trend.
It is. And I think one final thought is, I think a lot of people misinterpret the idea of making reality more like games. There's this the trend of gamification. They misinterpret that as, we should keep score, we should give people badges and buttons and all this nonsense. Whereas what attracts people to games, there are all kinds of games out there, but what attracts people to the best games is not, I get a star every 30 seconds and I love that. It's the game is challenging, the game is absorbing, I'm mastering difficult skills. Gradually, it's not too difficult, it's not too easy. I'm cooperating with people, I have a sense of autonomy, and I can make choices, and the choices make a difference. That is the way in which we should say, well, reality has something to learn from games, rather than, reality should have more glittery stars and more kind of bonus shields and all that nonsense.
Yep. Let's go to the next example. I love this one. It's from the chapter Ideas About Ideas, and it's the story of intellectual property and Charles Dickens in America. Tim, Dickens did not think much of us coarse Americans, did he?
Well, I know. I think he loved the Americans. He just didn't love American intellectual property law. So Dickens shows up on a campaign in America, really. He arrives in Boston, and he wants America to change its copyright law, because America has copyright, but it doesn't respect foreign authors. So people are just ripping off Dickens novels wholesale, often very bad copies, very bad quality, stick any jacket they like on them and sell them for very low rates. And Dickens didn't get any royalties. And he thought, he compared this, it's a typical Dickens kind of metaphor, to being robbed in the street and then paraded in public through clothes that you didn't choose in disgraceful company, because he didn't get money, he couldn't control the appearance of his books, he couldn't control where they appeared in the bookshops. So he wanted copyright law to be changed. He quickly ran into trouble because American newspapers at the time benefited a great deal from being able to take whatever content they wanted from British newspapers. So they just tried to assassinate Dickens' character, and he had a pretty miserable experience. So that's where the story of intellectual property begins. And then I talk about this whole idea of intellectual property as a balancing act. You're trying to reward creators, not for moral reasons, but for purely economic reasons. You want to encourage people to create new ideas, whether it's a novel or whether it's a better steam engine. So you need to give them some kind of intellectual monopoly for a while. But if you give them too strong an intellectual monopoly, too deep, too long-lasting, you can then strangle innovation. And I talk about the theories of Michele Baldwin and David Levine, who have this book, Against Intellectual Monopoly, which argues that basically this is incredibly counterproductive. And if you look at the historical record, innovation starts when the patent expires. The patent doesn't really seem to encourage innovation. Now, I think they've probably taken their argument a bit too far, but it's very interesting to reflect on all the ways in which you can make money even in the absence of intellectual property. And in the end, Charles Dickens comes back to America. He's trying to make money. His marriage is in trouble. His children are spending a lot of cash. And he realizes, hang on, I can go on a speaker tour. And he goes on this lecture tour of America, reading passages from his books, particularly Christmas Carol, very, very popular. He makes a ton of money, $25 million in today's money, not from his books, but from the lectures, because everybody's read the cheap knockoff copies of his books. He's very, very famous, and he's able to cash in the end. So it tells us that the story of intellectual property is not as simple as we think it is.
The ending to that story is amazing. He basically came across the first freemium model, and he hated it. He hated every step of the way until the very end when he was cashing out and he realized that it worked in his case.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And he's not the first person to figure this one out. So, not the last. Matthew Boulton and James Watt. So Watt develops a better steam engine. Matthew Boulton, very politically influential partner of James Watt, lobbies in Parliament. They get the patent on Watt's steam engine extended by Act of Parliament. No one else can build a similar steam engine. And they spend years and years and years just suing their rivals and suppressing innovation in the steam engine industry in the UK. And finally, when the patent does expire, there's suddenly this almost Precambrian explosion of ideas in industry, lots and lots of better ways to make steam engines. Meanwhile, what happens to James Watt and Matthew Boulton? Well, they go back and go, well, I guess we can't sue people anymore. I guess we'd better just build really good steam engines. And they do, and they make more money than ever before. So then you've got to start asking the question, well, who did that patent serve? It didn't even seem to serve Boulton and Watt, because once it expired, they did better than they had done beforehand.
Okay, next up, from the chapter Inventing the Wheel, the invention of index funds.
Yeah. And in fact, the wheel is not in the chapter Inventing the Wheel, but the whole idea of that chapter is there are some inventions that just seem to be so simple and so basic. Once you've invented them once, you've nailed it, and that's it. And the wheel is one of them. And yeah, index funds, very interesting. Which Paul Samuelson, the Nobel Prize winning economist, towards the end of his life, he gave a speech praising the index fund, and he said it ranks alongside the wheel, the plow, wine and cheese, and the printing press as among man's greatest inventions. So he was fond of the index fund, but then he had a role in its creation. Samuelson had published this essay in around 1974, if I remember rightly, called Challenge to Judgment, where he basically said, okay, Samuelson is one of the pioneers of the efficient markets hypothesis, which is not completely true, but it's reasonably true. And the simplest way, Alpha Chat listeners will know about the efficient markets hypothesis, but the simplest way I think of is to think, when you are queuing up in the supermarket, which checkout line do you choose? Well, if it was obvious, everyone would already have gone in that line and it wouldn't be the shortest line anymore. So you probably don't need to worry too much. Just pick anyone. And that's the efficient markets hypothesis in a nutshell. If there were obvious bargains in the stock market or any other asset markets, they would already have been snapped up, and so there are no obvious bargains. So Samuelson has pioneered this hypothesis and discussed it, and then he says, well, hang on. If there are no obvious bargains in the stock market, then professional investors might struggle to beat just the index, just some average of all the stocks. And he goes away and tries to figure out whether they have, and his essay, Challenge to Judgment, says, no, active managers don't beat the index. Which is now a very, very familiar idea. But Samuelson pushed it 42 years ago. And at the end of his article, he says, you know what, someone should set up an index fund that just tracked the index. And reading this article was a gentleman called John Bogle, who founded Vanguard. And Bogle was interested in setting up a super low-cost fund investment vehicle. And he reads Samuelson's article and says, well, what could be a more natural vehicle for low-cost investments than a passive index tracker? So he sets up a passive index tracker. And of course, everybody laughs at him and nobody signs up, because why would you sign up for a fund that is guaranteed to be mediocre? But we now know that Bogle and Samuelson had the last laugh, because slowly but surely, Vanguard is and the other passive investment funds are eating the active fund industry, but it took a long, long time.
Yeah, something I learned in this chapter was the sheer resistance that John Bogle faced to his idea. Because yes, people laughed at him, but they didn't just laugh. I mean, they actively thought it was a terrible idea, and some people called it un-American. I didn't realize the extent to which he had to overcome entrenched, I guess, industry resistance to the introduction of this idea.
Yeah, no, I'm not quite sure what exactly the un-American thing is. Maybe it's the idea that all shares are equally good, so let's just buy a little bit of everything. Maybe that's the idea, that there's something sort of vaguely communist or communitarian about it. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything really un-American about the idea that markets work really well, so you should just sit back and enjoy that ride.
I have a suspicion, and I have no evidence for this, that part of the problem here was linguistic. When you hear the phrase passive, that itself has a connotation of being somewhat un-American, right? So the American idea of always choosing your own destiny, of always, charging forward, being active. Passive sounds like the opposite of that. So even though in this case it was being applied to a really great idea, I think it just triggered like a very sharp association in the minds of the people who criticized it. I'm just making that up.
No, you may be right. It's like, oh, it sounds a bit Mediterranean. It's what the Italians would do, or the Greeks. They would just, or the French. Oh, yes, the French. I mean, they're just sitting under the shade of some apple tree somewhere, not doing anything. And, you know, American investors, you know, churn and trade and pay high fees. So, yeah, you may be right, Cardiff.
Let's go to the next one. Passports from the chapter Winners and Losers. Passports, Tim, it turns out, were not invented to get you past like the border guard. In fact, originally, there were tools that were used to strike fear into those border guards, essentially.
Yeah, it was a threat. Don't let this person pass, or you'll have me to deal with. Yeah, that was the original document. But what really struck me about the passport, apart from the fact that it was nearly abandoned just before the First World War, everyone was like, what's the point of this? And we if we hadn't had that war, we might have gone on a very different track to a situation where there was complete freedom of movement across the world. And your main obstacle, if you're African and you want to move to Europe, the challenge is not the passport. The challenge is, well, where are you going to live? How are you going to support yourself? Why, you know, how are you going to get a job? Rather than we will stop you crossing the border. But the other thing that really struck me, which I thought was beautiful, was the original French passports were designed to stop people leaving. So you have skills, and you're not allowed to leave town without a passport. So the whole system is to regulate exit, not to regulate entry. And I wish we had a bit more of that view these days, that people who move countries, they've got skills, they've got determination, they've got autonomy, they need to be respected as human beings, but they're also very valuable economically. And we should be more worried about people leaving the country than worried about all the people who are showing up. So sadly, we seem to have lost that insight that the French understood in the 18th century.
Yeah, that's right. Let's go to Leaded Gasoline, and that's from the chapter The Visible Hand. And to extend the phrase, I think the visible hand of government and its role in fostering new inventions.
Yeah, or I mean, sometimes the stories are about unexpected ways in which government has helped. So the iPhone is the classic. I think people don't appreciate just, obviously, Steve Jobs and Apple created the iPhone, but they were building it from building blocks that in large part had been funded by governments, usually the American government and usually the American military. In other stories, I'm talking about ways in which government messed things up and delayed inventions. And in leaded gasoline, leaded petrol, as I would call it, the story here is about government failing to regulate what was really a dreadful toxin. And we're only still only now starting to understand quite how much damage lead in petrol, tetraethyl lead in gasoline, was doing. And yet it's not like... not like climate change, where decarbonizing the economy is really, really, really hard. De-leadifying, this is not really a phrase, but getting the lead out of gasoline, not that hard, not that expensive. But there was a real corporate stranglehold over the scientific debate. Companies like General Motors and Exxon were funding most of the research and really managed to delay sensible regulation of leaded gasoline for a long time. And there's a tragic story. So Thomas Midgley, who is the guy who invented tetraethyl lead in gasoline, that was his first invention. He nearly killed himself washing his hands in gasoline, in tetraethyl imbued gasoline in front of Congress. So he washes his hands and he says, I'm not taking any risk whatsoever. I mean, he spent months recovering from lead poisoning. Then his next invention is CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which later turn out to be destroying the ozone layer. I mean, this is not his fault. It's just a doomed inventor. His third invention, he suffered from polio. And so he invented this winch for getting himself out of bed. And one morning it tangled up around his neck and hung him. He was killed by his third invention.
Yeah, I chose leaded gasoline and also the next entry, in part to show that this was 50 things that shaped the modern economy, or in the UK, 50 things that made the modern economy, because you don't say necessarily always for the better. And of course, the forward march of technology tends to benefit us enormously. I mean, these things bring largely wonderful things to our lives, but they can often have quite brutal unintended effects, and sometimes they do in fact make our lives worse. Leaded gasoline was a good example of these kinds of complexities, but so is the next century, the Haber-Bosch process, from the chapter Where Do Inventions Come From?
So the Haber-Bosch process, I mean, this is, I think, perhaps the most important invention in the book, certainly the most important invention since 1800.
Yeah, Tim, it's interesting that you say that, because that's actually the one that I knew the least about going into the book.
Yeah, so the Haber-Bosch process was invented by Fritz Haber and commercialized by, I think, Carl Bosch, but I focus on Fritz Haber in the chapter. And it is a process for getting nitrogen out of the atmosphere and fixing it into fertilizer, which nitrogen is a very important mineral in soils. And yet, although it is the key component of the atmosphere, 80% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, plants can't get nitrogen out of the atmosphere directly. They have to get it out of the soil. And so it used to be that the way you would do that is, well, animal manure contains nitrates, that's fine, or guano from birds or bats. That was the next thing. So then you had guano wars, people worrying about a world guano shortage because guano was such a great fertilizer and we're running out of it. And then along comes Fritz Haber, and he invents this process by which if you put enough energy in, you can get a chemical fertilizer out of the atmosphere. Brot aus Luft, the Germans said, bread from the air. And the world population would probably be about 3 billion rather than 7 billion if it wasn't for the Haber-Bosch process. And Cardiff, you about a pound of your body is nitrogen, and it's all chemically synthesized, the whole lot. So you are about 1 pound of your flesh was made in a laboratory somewhere. So the Haber-Bosch process is very, very important. The reason I wanted to tell the story is because the story of Fritz Haber and his wife, Clara Immerwahr, is absolutely remarkable. So she got the first doctorate in chemistry in Germany awarded to a woman. Very ambitious, smart young woman, married Fritz Haber, and then her career completely trashed by his career. Every contribution she made, everyone assumed that Fritz Haber had made it. And then along comes the First World War, and Fritz Haber, great German patriot, realizes, oh, hang on, not only can I synthesize chemical fertilizer, I can use the same method to synthesize ammonia for bombs, and I can also develop chlorine gas. So he's the pioneer in the use of chemical weapons during the First World War. He's responsible for the release of chlorine gas in the trenches at Ypres. He is promoted, given the rank of corporal, if I remember rightly. And he goes home to celebrate this with some friends. And his wife, Clara, takes his service revolver, have this blazing row. She takes his service revolver. She goes outside and she shoots herself. And it's just an absolutely appalling waste of this young woman's life. And she was totally marginalized and desperate to stop him doing what he did. And then in the end, Haber himself, although he saw himself as a great German patriot, he's also Jewish. And so after the First World War, he's a war hero, he's decorated, and then when the Nazis come in, he's protected for a while, and in the end he has to leave the country, and he dies alone in a hotel room in Switzerland in the 1930s, completely broken man. But he changed the world, he really did.
Yeah, yeah, that's an unbelievable story, and a really great chapter in the book. Why don't we close with an entry here that, you know, ends on somewhat of a lighter note, although it does involve the burning down of British Parliament.
Well, yeah, but I mean, not advocating the burning down of British Parliament, I should say, but yeah, so...
Tradable debt, I should say, otherwise known as money, and from the chapter Inventing New Systems, the tally stick.
Yeah, I love the tally stick. So there are some great books around about the history of money. One of them is by Felix Martin. One of them is by William Goetzmann. Called Money Changes Everything, and there's David Graeber's book about the history of debt, the first 5,000 years, and they all touch on this mysterious thing called the tally stick, so I really wanted to go and find out more. And the tally stick is this brilliant way of recording a debt. It's on a stick of willow, used in England in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. And you write your debt on the stick of willow with certain marks, who owes whom, how much money. And then you split the stick lengthways. And so you've got something called the foil and the stock. And of course, stocks are still a term for financial instruments. And the original stock was made of willow wood. And the great thing is that when you come to repay the debt, you can redeem the debt and rejoin the two pieces of wood, which match up perfectly. So you can establish there's been no forgery of this debt because the two halves of the pieces of wood will match and the writing on them will match. So they were a very good way of recording a debt. The interesting thing is you could then allow the foil, I think it was the stock, you then allow the stock to circulate. So you've got someone owes you money. So you've got a debt from, say, Fulke Bassett, who's a bishop in High Wycombe. You've got a debt from Fulke Bassett for £5. And it's all marked on this stick. So now Fulke Bassett owes you £5. But then, Cardiff, say I want to buy something from you. I could say, well, rather than rustling around and trying to get coins, why don't I just give you this stick that says Fulke Bassett owes you £5? And you might say, yeah, well, that's pretty convenient. I mean, it's a lot more convenient than... I'm not worried about getting paid back by Fulke Bassett. Everyone knows Fulke Bassett. He's a bishop. He's good for the money. So you take the debt. And then maybe you want to buy something off Amy, your brilliant producer. And so rather than giving her money, you give her the stick. And then so the stick circulates. And it's something magic just happened. It's become money. And you realize money is debt of tradable form. So that the original debtor is entirely separate from this process by which this thing circulates. And it turns out we see this process happening again and again across economic history with the Irish banking strike in the 1970s, the Irish writing each other checks, even though there are no banks, there are no bank accounts, no one can ever check whether these checks are valid. And these checks just circulate and they keep getting endorsed and endorsed and endorsed. And the checks turn into money. Months later, the banks reopen and people finally pay these checks into bank accounts and it's all settled again. So it's a wonderful illustration of what money really is. The kicker to the story is that, well, you might think when you think about money, you think about coins, right? Coins are when you think about money through history, you think about coins. That's because coins last. You go to any museum of monetary history, it's all coins. Because these other things like tally sticks and paper IOUs, they don't last very well. And in particular, these tally sticks didn't last because some genius in the British Parliament decided they were going to burn 6 centuries of monetary records because they'd switched to a paper-based system. Why do we need all these willow sticks? They decided to burn the lot. It was an absolutely irreplaceable historical resource, the monetary history of the United Kingdom. Burn the lot. Unfortunately, they decided to burn them in a stove that was designed for coal. Lots and lots of little wooden sticks, raging chimney fire. They set fire to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords set fire to the House of Commons, and the entire British Parliament burned down. And so the building that we now think of, the Palace of Westminster, that was the replacement for the original Houses of Parliament, because they were burned down by vandals who thought it was a brilliant idea to destroy all the tally sticks. So it was like the gods of monetary history having their revenge.
Yeah, you closed that chapter with that nice line about the vengeance of the monetary gods. There's 43 more of these in the book and in the podcast series. I happily endorse it. It's totally delightful. But Tim, I want to close by asking you about the drivers of technology. And there's an interesting diversity of the incentives that end up producing these 50 technologies. And I think I'm asking this question in part because we had Stephen Johnson himself on the podcast earlier this year to discuss Wonderland, which you cited at the top of the show as one of the inspirations behind doing this series. And to remind our listeners, the theme of that book was that very often economic advances are made because people have a sense of play, because people want to enjoy themselves. So it's not out of some basic necessity. It's just because they want to, they want to enjoy a new fad, a new kind of fashion. And these, again, the reverberations here can be quite astonishing. So something that begins as a simple advance ends up changing the way we live for you know, forever in some cases. But that's not the only kind of demand-side driver of these technologies. There's also military necessity. There is just a straightforward making money when, you know, you change the processes that you use in making things. I guess I want to ask, what did you learn about what produces new technologies and new inventions? What surprised you?
I think the most surprising thing is that there's no simple answer, that there is an amazing diversity of processes. Sometimes we don't even know who invented concrete. We know who invented reinforced concrete, but some of these inventions are very, very old, or it doesn't really matter, or they've been invented many times. Paper was invented in China and then moved to the Middle East, and then the Europeans just didn't take it up for hundreds of years. They're like, why do we need this stuff? It's like having a cheap writing surface is like having a cheap material to make crowns out of. You know, all we want to do is make Bibles, so we don't need your paper. So it's partly about the invention, it's partly about the adoption, but there are lots of different accounts in the book. So there are times where there's a very clear problem. Air conditioning was invented because they wanted to dehumidify printing. And so they understood pretty much how to do it. And it turned out once you do it, oh, as well as dehumidifying, you make it cooler. Maybe we could use that elsewhere. Sometimes it's this flash of inspiration. So Joseph Woodland, the inventor of the barcode, he was just sitting on a beach and he was thinking about Morse code. And he dragged his fingers lazily in a circle. And then he looked down at the sand, you know, the sand running between his fingertips. And he saw these ridges in a target pattern. And he thought to himself, well, I could make those ridges signify dots and dashes. So there's the idea of thin and thick lines representing a kind of code. And that was the origins of the barcode. So lots and lots of different origin stories. Sometimes the origin story is absolutely central. Sometimes it's irrelevant. And the focus of the book is not particularly on where good ideas come from. Stephen has another great book called Where Good Ideas Come From. It's well worth a read. But when I was talking to Stephen Johnson about Wonderland, there was an interesting parallel between Wonderland and my previous book, Messy, which we discussed on Alpha Chat last year. We're both interested in the subject of attention. So in Messy, I talk about obstacles and problems focusing attention. Suddenly you have a stranger in the room, you have a tool that's not working, you have an impossible deadline. And that pressure, that anxiety forces you to think really hard and produce creative responses. So Stephen has a much more positive take. He says, well, yeah, sure, that can work. But here's another thing. You're playing with ideas, you're engaged, you're having fun, you're delighted. That's another way to focus your attention, a lot, much more fun way to focus your attention. And that can also be a source of creativity.
Not that you're a downbeat guy normally or anything, but did writing this book make you more optimistic somehow?
I loved writing it. I had such fun going through the technological histories. I suppose it did make me optimistic in the sense of when you look at all the different problems we humans have solved across the centuries, you think of all the ways in which our lives have become better. Many times I've looked at inventions that made life so much easier and we take them for granted now. I think you can't help but be an optimist. These inventions have often had unintended consequences. They have often created problems we now need to deal with, in particular environmental problems, but also potentially technological joblessness. The robots come and take our jobs. But overall, we need to be grateful. The final chapter in the book is about the light bulb, talking about a very famous study by the economist Bill Nordhaus. And the story of the light bulb is just one 10,000-year journey from light becoming impossibly expensive to light becoming absurdly cheap, and all of the ways in which that's enriched our lives. And we can't get our minds around the scale of the advance, just how much better things have got on that dimension. So I wanted to finish the book by talking about the light bulb because I wanted to remind people all the inventions, all the ideas of all our ancestors have gone to shaping the world we live in today, and mostly they have made our lives incomparably easier compared to the lives of our parents, our grandparents, and previous generations.
And on that very eloquent note, I think it's a perfect place to end our conversation. Tim, I actually want to close by doing a short long-form recommendation segment. We haven't done this in a while, and I didn't prepare you for it. So I'll go first while you think of something, if that's okay.
No, I have something at the top of my mind, but you go first. Go ahead.
Okay, I will. Inspired by your chapter on Dickens and intellectual property, there was an article in The New Yorker by Jill Lepore in 2011 on the experience of Dickens in America that tells the story that you offered in quite a bit of detail. It's fantastic. The other is episode 780 of Planet Money. Tells the story of novelist Cory Doctorow also changing his mind about intellectual property, how it should be designed and how it should be enforced. And you'll see that there are some parallels there, again, with the story of Dickens. We'll have links to both of these, again, in the show notes. Tim, what is your long-form recommendation for our listeners?
Well, I immediately need to go and read the Jill Lepore piece, which I haven't read, because if Jill has written something about it, she's definitely spotted things that I've missed. So I need to go and check that out. And Corey, by the way, has a very interesting book out called Walk Away, all about... I guess deep down, it's a book about the Coase theorem, but it's a science fiction novel with, you know, lots of, you know, sex and death and all kinds of, and dystopian. It's a really interesting book. Maybe Corey would not be happy that I'm saying he's written a book about the Coase theorem, but it's kind of what it is about. And obviously a dystopian future full of killer drones and genetic engineering and all of that, but it's really about the Coase theorem. But my long form recommendation is Cal Newport's book Deep Work, which was published a couple of years ago and which I read this weekend. And it is a book about the value of focus, of not constantly relieving your anxiety by immediately turning to social media, Facebook, Twitter, distracting yourself, making yourself feel busy and making yourself feel productive, but actually you're not doing anything of any great value. It was full of stuff I already knew, and yet somehow I found it very valuable to read, and I did enjoy it very much. And I have changes planned to try to get more done, and not only get more done, but also to appreciate and be mindful of the fun things that I get to do in my life and not just constantly distract myself. So Deep Work by Cal Newport. Very good.
Tim Harford, thanks so much for being on Alpha Chat again. The book is In the UK, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. In the US, 50 Inventions That Shaped the Modern Economy. Definitely pick it up. Tim, always a pleasure, man.
It's been great. Thank you.
And that is the end of our chat with Tim Harford. Give us a call at 917-551-5012. That is country code +1 because we are based in the U.S. Email us at alphachat@ft.com. And please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. I know I say this every week, but it really is true that it helps other people find out about us. And finally, show notes to all the links we discussed here, plus some other stuff about this episode and all prior episodes, are at ft.com/alphachat. The invention that shaped the modern iteration of Alpha Chat is the mind of Amy Keene, 14 billion years of evolution in the making. Thanks for everything, Amy, and thanks to our listeners. We'll see you here again next week for another episode of Alpha Chat.